Hello. As you can see, I have nothing to disclose. Well, no corporate relationships. I could probably spend all day talking about all my other fun relationships. I'm just going to read you a story. I'm hoping that the story sort of highlights a lot of the tensions that that we find in doing participatory action research on our particular project. So I'm not going to claim to be an expert on this community. I'm only going to claim to be an expert on my own experiences working in the community. Some of the tensions I'd like to just point out real quick. I see a tension between this idea of expert leaders and collaborative learners. So that's one tension. A real strong tension between kind of short-term goals and long-term visions. And another tension between the idea of personal empowerment and collective power. I'm driving to Simpkins again. Although it's 6 a.m., I'm really pretty excited about the day. It seems that we have finally done it. We have finally found a way to engage with and support a group of citizens in their efforts to change their food system. The issue definitely was not perfect, but if these folks could help get the city council to change their mind, they could get a taste of their power, their ability to impact Simpkins. It may not be perfect, but it was progress. There were finally other voices at the table, voices from folks who were experiencing firsthand the problems that the coalition was trying to help address through community organizing. From another perspective, there was less blaming. That is, blaming the community's problems on the personal habits, desires, and the knowledge of the people most affected by those problems. Today I was taking this newly formed group on a tour of community kitchens and incubator farms. We were traveling across the border into the neighboring state. I was excited for multiple reasons. First, I just like to witness efforts to share resources, support small business owners, and I wanted to hear more about how these efforts were funded. But the main reason I was excited to experience this day was the fact that it had the potential to seed vision, the potential to open up new conversations about what this community could look like. These were big ideas. And community leaders like Glenda understood the vision. But she traveled all over the world. She saw problems, talked to people. She and other community leaders had experienced alternate solutions to the common problems faced by rural communities, and they could imagine the kind of large shifts in thinking that could really help make changes. This new group was different. Some folks traveling with us today had said they'd never left Simpkins County, let alone the state. So this trip could have a huge impact on whether they would be able to imagine a world different than the one they grew up in, imagine a different kind of justice, imagine a world where they were actively changing the world, not just suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. At a little before 7 a.m., I am pulling into Simpkins. My excitement was only tempered a bit by the fact that I had tried to contact Jacqueline the evening before to talk about a mix-up of state vehicles. Jacqueline is our community organizer, and she was working with the group to make sure they would be ready to leave early, even picking up those that needed a ride. I was hoping to check in with her about the number of expected folks because we weren't able to get the larger 15-passenger van like we had originally planned. Instead, we had an 8-passenger van. I worried because we had 9 people originally signed up to go in our van, and I felt that there was a possibility that we would have to get a little creative in how people traveled in the unlikely event that all our folks and all the city council members showed up. We might have to make a choice about who got left behind. As I pulled into the parking lot, it didn't appear this was going to be a problem. There was only 3 people in the lot and 1 more person pulling in behind me. Jacqueline, Glenda, the mayor were milling around. I now felt my heart sink in another way. What if we didn't have any folks show up? It would be a long drive back, but I suppose I could always use the extra time to work. As I got out, I said hi to Glenda and to Jacqueline. They both looked worried, but Jacqueline looked downright depressed. I asked her how she was, and her reply was that it had been a long night. I waited a few moments to see if she would continue, and when she wasn't forthcoming, I assumed it was a personal issue with her family and that she didn't feel comfortable going into it at this time. I asked Glenda where everyone was, and she said the city council folks would be coming along shortly. Glenda, then, with the mayor, asked whether it was okay for the mayor to put her things in my van. Glenda saw my hesitation, and she pulled me aside to talk. She explained the situation to me. It seems that when Glenda found out from Jacqueline that we only had an 8-passenger van, she had Jacqueline call all the folks signed up for our van and tell them that there was no longer any room for them on the trip, on the tour. I wasn't following her logic and asked Glenda about what had happened to the van she had reserved for the city council leaders. She said that after Jacqueline had told them about us, about our research team organizing a second van, a 15-passenger van, she had canceled their van so everyone could ride together. She said that they didn't find out about the 8-passenger van until after 7 p.m. the night before, and it was already too late to reserve another van. I was still really confused and went to Jacqueline to get the story from her. She communicated the same thing, saying how heartbreaking it was to call those folks at 10 p.m. the night before we were scheduled to leave. I said that I had tried contacting her in the afternoon about the van, that if she would called me earlier, then this could have been resolved. It appeared, however, that her phone had died earlier in the day, and she was busy running from meeting to meeting and hadn't had a chance to check email until after 7. I asked her why she hadn't called us at 7, why she hadn't sorted things out with us, the research team. She didn't have a response. This whole mess was making me very angry. I needed to step away from Jacqueline and Glenda both. I didn't know what to do. I was there to drive our community participants. I didn't even think it was appropriate for us to fund the city council leaders on a tour of community kitchens when they could fund themselves. I couldn't seem to calm my brain. The last thing Glenda said before I walked off was that I would have to drive the council folks, otherwise everyone would look bad and the whole thing would be called off. So now I was feeling bullied. I wasn't sure exactly why, but I was becoming extremely mistrustful of Glenda. She was very calmly arranging things, and what she was arranging was a storyline that suggested negligence on the part of our team. She was clearly placing blame on us for this problem and also putting pressure on me in particular to correct it. Besides an initial mistrust of Glenda, someone I already knew to be extremely manipulative, I began placing a lot of blame on Jacqueline. She was working for us, and why hadn't she called me back or anyone else from our team, including her supervisor? I decided to call the principal investigator, my academic advisor, and ask her opinion. I was audibly upset, and to her credit, she acknowledged it by listening. She paused only a moment, though, before her reply, that to preserve relationships with the community partners, it would be best for me to drive the council reps. She would leave the choice to me, but that was her recommendation. She said that we would sort this out later. Although her response calmed me, helping me feel less at fault and less alone in coming up with a resolution, I still felt hurt and angry. I still felt that there were a lot of unanswered questions, and I felt like once again we were taking a huge step back in our efforts. We had been building relationships in Simpkins for almost a year, but it had been about 6 months since we really began pursuing a working relationship, and I myself was introduced to the community and the people. The first time I met Glenda, I was very surprised by what I found. I'm not sure exactly what I expected, but it definitely wasn't this woman standing across from me, this woman who resembled a younger version of my grandmother. My grandmother, as I remembered her, was short, curly gray hair, glasses, sort of nondescript, as if the features that had defined her in her youth had been covered over with the lines and excess skin associated with aging. I'd been hearing stories about Glenda for months, stories from a member of our research team who had sat in on Simpkins County Coalition meetings, stories about Glenda's audacity, her nerve, her charm, and particularly her competency in getting things done for her community. One common story told how, when she discovered the city police department didn't own bulletproof vests, she had led an effort to raise the money and purchase enough for each member of the force. I knew that she had retired to this community as a way to be near her aging mother and to look after her, and that she currently directed a local nonprofit whose focus was on rural economic development through agricultural endeavors, and that she had found funding to revitalize a vacant hardware store, turning it into a farmer's market and community kitchen. So now, instead of standing in front of this larger-than-life force, I was shaking hands with someone who brought up visions of homemade pumpkin pie and games of Chinese checkers. Until today, much of what we knew about Simpkins was through the lens of the one woman who'd been attending coalition meetings and describing her encounters with the group. Today, I traveled with other members of our research team. We had come a-courtin', so to speak. The Simpkins coalition had proven effective at getting funds. They had proven a level of commitment that we hadn't seen in many other county coalitions, and so we were attending a meeting in order to gauge their interest in partnering with us on our research project. Most of what we saw in community coalitions established to address childhood obesity was that they were coalitions in name only. They were coalitions in the sense that coalitions were a necessary criteria for receiving community transformation grant funding, but were not necessarily working well as a group, not necessarily committed to making deep and lasting change in the community. Simpkins was different, and they had projects in motion to prove it. We believed that they, more than any other coalition, would benefit from what we had to offer as a research partner, that the resources would go further and have a greater impact. We arrived in Simpkins a bit early and decided to stop by a local restaurant for a cup of coffee. Bill's family restaurant was along what is typically called the business route, a branch of the highway that travels through the heart of town, but for most travelers, it is the route you take if you want to see how dilapidated a town has become. Bill's is the kind of restaurant that would have been packed before the alternate route was put in, packed even at the odd hour between 9:30 and 10 a.m., after the breakfast crowd and before the lunch crowd. The staff didn't appear to be expecting visitors, and I remember feeling a bit out of place as I entered with our particular mix of African-American and white professionally dressed colleagues. The townsfolk didn't pay us much attention, and the waitstaff were kind and offered friendly service. The only other clients were a group of older white men at the counter and three middle-aged black men who came in behind us. I thought about how the racial mix of the clients reflected what I understood of the demographics of the town, a southern town where the whites were a slight minority. I asked the waiter whether they would get pretty busy today for lunch, and he said that, no, not today. They do most of their lunch business on Tuesday when court is in session. The county courthouse is just a few blocks away. This connection struck me. Here was a business that was indirectly, economically tied to the legal and justice system. Maybe crime didn't pay, but the criminal justice system was notably supporting this business. Criminal justice as a clear and identifiable economic driver. The other information I knew about Simpkins was that it had lost about 15,000 manufacturing jobs over the past 8 years. The majority of them lost with the recession. Unemployment was over 20% at its height and still well over the national average. I briefly wondered if there was a way to link these two phenomena, the unemployment trends and the percentage of economic activity directly and indirectly attributed to criminal investigation and trial. We finished our coffee and traveled a few more blocks to a county building where the meeting was to be held. We entered through the foyer of a large box-shaped brick building and then into what appeared to be an old elementary school gymnasium. It was an unnaturally carpeted room with large painted concrete walls. On the far side of the room were two separate hallways, each leading to a seemingly random mix of county offices and departments. We sat down at a set of tables at one end of the large room. The meeting wasn't necessarily meant to be private, but it was slightly disruptive as county staff and community members traveled through the meeting space in order to get to the offices. The building seemed old and run down, even though the space was clean and organized. It had reminded me of another rural community development story, the story of Colquitt, Georgia, and how that story had begun because a local social worker thought the entire county suffered from a self-esteem problem. I do know that working in this building would negatively contribute to my self-esteem. Meeting members introduced themselves. The coalition leadership centered around three women, each representing a particular agency. We knew through stories that Melissa, the ED of a local service organization, was the head of the coalition. She had a cheerful demeanor and made it a point to keep things pleasant and rolling along. Roberta, an extension agent in charge of educational programs for kids, was the organizational leader of the group with calendars and computer, keeping track of notes and dates and commitments. She projected a serious, no-frills attitude and rarely spoke except to clarify points. And Glenda, the visionary and workhorse of the group, we knew that she was responsible for writing the big-picture grants and securing funding. There were other service organizations and health department people present, but their short introductions told me little more than their titles within the service and health organizations they were representing. We followed suit and briefly introduced ourselves with name and title. For myself, I was a PhD student in public health. The PI of the grant briefly added our standard shorthand about the research project, a 5-year project designed to document the use of community organizing and food systems change in communities. Although we felt rushed to get the meeting underway, I briefly wondered if perhaps we would have been better served by taking a moment to share our personal stories and use them as a way to direct discussion about shared values and missions. It wasn't until the end of the meeting when we had a chance to describe a potential partnership that we got the chance to communicate this information about interests in hunger, food access, nutrition, policy systems, and environmental changes. Still a lot of public health jargon, but it was familiar to Glenda and prompted her to pull out the farmers market plans and passionately describe the project. She talked about the desire to accept EBT cards at the market and allow folks to use their SNAP dollars to purchase directly from farmers. She had already researched the amount of SNAP dollars spent in Simpkins County and described the impact millions of dollars would have on the local economy if only we could redirect a portion toward local food producers and away from the big box stores. I think we were all impressed with her research and storytelling skills, as well as her ability to frame a health issue in economic terms that could focus energy. It was a storyline that could potentially even combat the negative stigma associated with receiving government aid. We left today feeling hopeful that this would be a good partnership, that this coalition was working on big projects that could have a positive impact on farmers as well as those experiencing the impacts of poverty and hunger. We did notice that there were no voices in the room that might represent people associated with either of these groups, but we felt that to be our job, our role in the partnership, find ways to reach out and bring more voices to the table. The next time I met Glenda, we were working towards setting up a training workshop that would start this process. We were at a bit of an impasse. Our team had designed a 2-day experience that would reach multiple goals. It would give the coalition leaders a sense of the power in community-based participatory research. It would draw attention to the leadership processes, the communication processes, and the personal values that inspired the work, all with the objective of aligning those values with the processes. These were fairly lofty goals on our part, and I don't think we were good at communicating the need. The coalition, on the other hand, was interested in short workshops that could strengthen marketing skills. They had hopes that a better understanding of social media would allow them to reach more people with a limited amount of resources available. The impasse was making folks a bit edgy, and Glenda seemed particularly annoyed that we were wasting time with such a workshop. We could get no further than set some tentative dates for about 6 weeks out. When the meeting was over, I had more of a chance to chat with Glenda. She asked after my wife, and although I answered, I realized pretty quickly that she didn't mean my wife, that she had assumed she was asking about the PI on our project, and that she had assumed that we were married. I jokingly told her that it would probably be inappropriate for me to be married to my academic advisor. I don't think she appreciated the joke, and perhaps it wasn't worth noting, but later I overheard her asking my colleague about what sort of job I had before getting laid off. It was another huge assumption on her part about me and my values, and I wish I could have answered her by suggesting that not everyone makes decisions for purely economic reasons, but she wasn't talking directly to me, and other distractions kept me from re-engaging her. The final thing I overheard Glenda mention before leaving was that she wanted to have a meeting with Sonia, with the PI. She wanted to know about when they would see the money for the staff position. Where was the contract? She said that the way things currently stood, they were doing all the work for us and we weren't helping them at all, either with the work or with the financial assistance to hire a staff person. It was interesting to hear this, and it makes me wonder if all her fishing for grandiose conjectures were a kind of underhanded fishing technique, an attempt to more fully understand the hierarchy of our organization and whether one of us had the power to write them a check. All of this gave me a clear sense of Glenda. Until now, we had mostly only experienced her charm, her capacity for warmth, her wit, her ability to tell a story, frame an issue, speak our language, the language of environmental policy and systems level change. She was smart, she got the big picture, and the proposals she developed were big picture evidence-based proposals. But now we saw a glimpse of the bully, the one who would push people around in order to get what she wanted. Glenda had often spoke with pride about the business she owned and ran before retirement. She'd been a Wall Street headhunter. She was accustomed to managing and controlling a situation through whatever means necessary, and I felt like we were being managed. Before this day, I felt I would have recommended without reservation that we partner with this community, I felt that this was a fantastic chance to see change in action and support real efforts. But now, after watching her question the nature and need for the workshops we had planned, and then question ourselves and our motives, I began to have doubts. Is this person and the coalition that she is de facto leader of, would they really embrace other voices? Would they really be open to trying out new ways of working in the community? I wasn't sure, and no longer 100% sure how we should proceed. Glenda was right. We hadn't officially signed anything, and if there was a chance to back out of a partnership, this would possibly be the last chance before we identified and hired a community organizer. I knew that my one voice on the research team wasn't a deciding voice, but I also felt confident that everyone on the team was heard and that if I were to recommend a different path, that other folks would at the very least seriously consider the request. I'll stop there. I have another section, but I'm out of time. One question or comment, or I honestly would appreciate any kind of comments or responses to the story that that you might have, and I think you can find my email address on there. So if there's anything that you'd like to share with me even after today, I would appreciate hearing that.
Thank you.